I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation always with variations on the theme at radioopensource.org. Talking this hour about and listening to Bach's Chaconne. This is a recording by Henry Schering from the mid-20th century. Part prayer, part pyrotechnics. This is the final movement of Bach's second partita in D minor for solo violin, the Chaconne. Like Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, which Huff on our website mentions, this is a test of ultimate mastery. It's a high-wire balancing act of musicality, technique, and interpretation that lasts for a lifetime. The guitar master Andres Segovia told his best students that every guitarist should play the Chaconne every day, but shouldn't even think of performing it in public until the age of 60. Our guest, Arnold Steinhardt, going strong after 40 years as first violinist of the Guarneri String Quartet, has written a memoir about violins and violining, Violin Dreams, that's just shot through with lore and love for this formidable dance. Post your own Chaconne thoughts at our site, www.radioopensource.org. We've been reading your posts all week. Arnold Steinhardt, we're talking about what Johannes Brahms thought was one of the most wonderful and most incomprehensible pieces of music in the canon. How do we approach talking about it?
Well, with great reverence and great joy and gratitude that it exists. I mean, it is one of those pieces that every violinist who wants to call himself a violinist has to study and has to play. On the other hand, it's been taken over by an incredible array of instruments you would think who shouldn't be playing the Chaconne. It shouldn't be on the piano unless you hear it played in the Brahms version, for example, which sounds very impressive.
The left hand at the piano.
Yes. I've heard it on the marimba. I've heard it played by two cellos. Somebody told me recently that it's been done by chorus. So it's gotten around by dint of it being such an awesome piece.
Let's talk about it, including the structure, passacaglia, a harmonic progression. It's only 8 bars in the original theme, and then what, 60 plus variations?
Well, depending on where, it's a 4-bar phrase, and sometimes it's coupled with another 4-bar phrase, and sometimes it stands alone. So there are basically 64 4-bar phrases, and they are strung together in a magical way by Bach. You can imagine that having a harmonic sequence with an underlying bass line repeated 64 times would be a colossal bore, and in the hands of a poor composer it certainly would be, but in Bach's hand it becomes a cathedral of sorts. It has those kind of proportions, those kind of dimensions to it.
We'll get into some of the metaphors that people use for this piece, but go back just to the structure. It sounds like certainly sounds like jazz in the sense of a theme and variations. It almost sounds like blues choruses on a harmonic idea, almost more than a melodic idea. But I wonder if you can you give us the four bars that we should, you know, that are implanted in our head listening?
Sure. It has to be said that while the Chaconne or the Passacaglia has a bass line that's supposed to be stuck to, in this case, it's Bach, when he repeats this, occasionally changes it. He changes the rules as if he's playing poker, and he decides in the middle that he's going to change the rules and have kings be ones and ones be kings, whatever. So he's crafty that way, and it's quite remarkable how he does that. He does that with a whole series of sequences that are supposed to be a set harmonic pattern. But this is the opening statement.
How much does that tell you about where we're going?
Well, he's given you four bars, and then he's given you another answering four bars. It's like a couple, a newlywed couple, I would say.
Second major metaphor, okay.
Sorry about that, Christopher.
From the cathedral to the couple, okay, we're going to keep score. But in the sense that, you know, people speak of great works of art having a kind of inevitability from the first paragraph or the first line of the poem or the first bars of the 60 plus variations. What is this setting out? Where is it pointing us?
I'm not sure I can answer this question. If I couldn't really answer this question, maybe I compose my own successful Chaconne. But he's established three major sections here. The first one is in minor, the second one is in major with a completely different character, and then he returns to minor. And so obviously he's got that as a kind of broad master plan. And then within that, he's strung these variations beautifully together. God only knows at the beginning whether he didn't say, well, maybe variation 17 should be variation 13. Let me try it that way. No, it works better as variation 17. We don't know that. But obviously what he came up with works beautifully because the evolution from one variation to another, from one section to another, just is masterful and very organic, to use an overused word.
What does it mean that it is, in some fashion, a dance?
Well, it was a dance. It said the Chaconne was said to have its roots in either Central America or South America, and it was supposed to be a very lusty dance. And the conquistadors heard it and brought it back to Spain, and it danced in such a lusty and lustful way that the church banned it. And it was sung, and they were flirtatious movements. It's not the only dance that's had that kind of interesting history. I think the Saraband shared a common fate. But the Chaconne was the worst of all of them in those terms. And because it was banned, perhaps that was the reason it was so popular, and it spread like wildfire across Europe. Hmm. And then as many of these dances evolved, so did the Chaconne. It became a court dance and then finally a piece of music that lost some of its dance roots. And yet, if you're to play it successfully, you have to feel it in three. It's inevitably in three. The stress is on the second beat. Not always, but in the crucial places.
Can you play it so that we hear not only the second beat in the three, but also the insinuation of a lusty dance?
Right. And I have to mention, this is something I mentioned in Violent Dreams, that, you know, as I struggle with this, I collared everybody on earth and played it for them as a young man, thinking I'd get some kind of secret key to this whole thing. And in fact, I did when I played it for a marvelous scholar and musician, Arthur Lesser, who listened to me play it and said, young man, sit down, I'm going to dance it for you. And he danced all the movements of the Bach D minor partita for me, which was a revelation. Not that I could dance it for you now, I can't, but just the essence of dance. So it's one, two. So if you were dancing the Chaconne, there would always be this natural weight on the second beat, or perhaps not always, but as I said, in crucial points.
Has Mark Morris attempted it, or I'm thinking?
Can I tell you?
The bebop drummer Jimmy Slide would have fun with that.
Yes, they certainly would. And the older I get, the more I sense, even in pieces of music that aren't supposed to be directly related to dance, there is the element of dance in all of music. And this is not just fast music, but slow music as well, I think. A sense of motion, certainly.
One more preliminary question about the structure. Bach wrote variations all over the place, including the famous Goldberg variations. How do we account for the difference here? And then we got to get to the mystique around this piece. This is not just music. This is a lifetime's meditation, a lifetime's practice.
But in addition to that, there is an aura of mystery around this piece. And even as a young kid, hearing it for the first time, when I heard the great violinist Misha Elman play it, I was 11 years old at the time, it not only made a monumental impression on me, I had the sense that there was some secret code in this piece. It was more than a piece of music. There was some kind of subliminal message in it. And all through my adolescent years playing it, I had the same sense about it. And then, you know, as a grown-up and beginning to read about it, I discovered that there is a great mystery with a great theory attached to it, in that he was in Köthen, Germany, where he was employed by Prince Leopold, and he went away to the spas because Leopold was a sickly man, and when he came back, his wife, Maria Barbara, was dead and buried. And one of the theories is that he wrote this as an article of grief for his wife. And when you think about it, the piece could have ended, the D minor partita could have ended with the fourth movement. It's a lively jig. So you have four nice movements. Then he goes and writes a chaconne, a fifth movement that's as long as all the four movements put together.
Thank goodness he did it. We're talking about Bach's chaconne with Arnold Steinhardt. And we'll hear how he learned it when we come back from a short break. This is Open Source from PRI.
Hi, this is Brendan. I am the Open Source Blogger-in-Chief. Every show on Open Source is open for public discussion before, after, and during the broadcast. Listeners suggest shows, suggest guests, share their reading lists, and then tell us what to ask. You can call this citizen journalism, or you can call us lazy, but you can find us at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking with Arnold Steinhardt about Bach's Chaconne, the last movement in D minor from Partita Number 2, a piece of music in the instrumental solo repertoire almost without equal for mystery and complexity of meanings. Gideon Kremer called the Chaconne a dance of life and death in the architecture of a cathedral. Arnold Steinhardt, you just said one clue to watch is that it's an autobiographical meditation from a mature Johann Sebastian Bach. Let's listen to a recording you made of the Chaconne 40 years ago, 1966. Every version, every time we hear it, is a sort of a new set of goosebumps and questions. What do you hear in young Arnold Steinhardt playing this piece?
Well, I recognize that guy Let me say that for starters. He's vaguely familiar to me. I recognize myself. I don't play it quite the same way now, but that's inevitable that you change. You have to change. You can't stop yourself from changing. But basically, the impulses are somewhat the same that I would have today.
Who coached you?
You don't have time enough for me to name all the people. I mean, I've played this many, many times for many people. I see all the performances I've heard coach me, all the recordings I've heard coach me.
Where did Isaac Stern come in?
Well, Isaac Stern was one of the most important coaches, I must say. There was a place called Meadowmount, which still exists, incidentally, where young violinists learn how to be great violinists. It's a kind of wonderful slave camp where you practice 8 hours a day, and it was created by Ivan Galamian, the great violin pedagogue who was my teacher. And he knew that practicing 8 or 10 hours a day was not the only way to learn how to be a musician. And he would invite wonderful people to the camp. He invited Isaac Stern. And Isaac got up and gave a lecture demonstration of the chaconne. Mm. He took it apart as if it was an engine on a car, you know, to show you the cylinders, the tappets, the rods. And he showed some very revealing things about the variations, about how to group the variations together, how one variation would tip its hand in showing you what the next variation was going to be. And then at the end, he played it for us. And it was great, great playing. And, you know, the place erupted in applause. And he stopped the applause and he said, "And furthermore, I want you to know that I was nervous."
You know, that's interesting. I often think St. Paul, in his letter to the Romans, said, "We have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." It seems to me that every musician's confession is, "We have all sinned and fallen short of Johann Sebastian Bach."
Of course. Of course. But the idea of a musician as a mechanic who has to take a car apart and then put it back together again so it runs, and it runs successfully. Mm. I mean, in a way, it sounds terribly mundane, but this is what the profession entails, certainly at its most important level. Then if there's some magic that happens above and beyond that, you know, that's this marvelous fringe benefit.
Let's talk about how you do it. I mean, the fingers on the strings and the tricks and traps in this piece. And the sheer difficulty of it.
Well, the sheer difficulty is that he's got 1, 2, 3, and 4 voices going at once. And we violinists are crooners, basically. You know, we play one note at a time. We're singers. And if we have to play 2 notes at a time, it's difficult. 3 notes gets very difficult. And often with 4 notes, we're flummoxed. Mm. It's not just the technical difficulty of playing that, but we have to juggle all the different voices, which are quite independent. Now, this is a pianist's mother's milk. A pianist has to do that from day one, but we learn that with difficulty.
Demonstrate the 4 voices. I mean, these are 4 fingers on the piano. I mean, four.
You have it in this arpeggio section. First, you have 3. And let's see if I can find this where it comes. Here. There's one place where there are 4 notes as well. But certainly in the beginning, you know. There you have 3 and 4 note chords. So there's that difficulty. And there's the other difficulty of being by yourself, which means there's no rest. There's no piano to give you a little bit of a breather. So it becomes something of a marathon.
And he instructed that there should be no bass accompaniment here.
That's right. You are the bass, you are the treble, and you are the voices in between.
Might he have thought, I ought to arrange these 4 voices for a quartet? He knew that He knew that game too.
Oh, yes, he did. He was obviously a master composer. But the other thing he was a very fine violinist. One of his sons said in the obituary of Bach that my father played with a clean and penetrating sound. Mm. And so he was a fine violinist. And actually in Köthen, where he was employed by the prince, he wasn't employed as a keyboard player. He was employed as the leader of the orchestra, which meant he led with a violin in his hands.
Hmm. What does that demand, or what does it teach a violinist to be, in effect, orchestrating four voices? What does it demand?
Well, I mean, a complete knowledge of the violin, but this goes so far with Bach that he can juggle a 3- and 4-voiced mm-hmm. fugue, as he does in the sonatas.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, other people have attempted it, but he does it masterfully. And so he is, and he knows how to use open strings beautifully because of his knowledge of the instrument. So he employs them to great effect in terms of the violin's sonority and the highlighting certain notes with open strings. So it's not only inspiring, it's very clever.
Quartet music is your life, after all. I'm just thinking flippantly. I mean, this violates the union rules in a certain sense. It's getting one man to carry the whole burden. How does it reflect back on your quartet work?
Well, you know, there was a violinist in the Kolisch Quartet, and the Kolisch Quartet played by memory, and Felix Kuhner was the second violinist for a while, and second violin parts are notoriously difficult to memorize, and Felix was asked how he did it. He said, oh, it's very simple. He says, I just play the part I don't hear. So, I mean, ideally when you're playing any piece of music, you have to hear all the parts. A fine conductor conducting Beethoven's Eroica will hear all the parts. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we string quartet players, to be any good at our trade, have to hear all the parts. And so it's no different when you're playing on your own, theoretically.
Speaking of conductors, Daniel Barenboim, in conversation with us recently, remarked that the music stays the same. It's we, the musicians and the audience, the change. You played this continuously now for 40 plus years. The music is the same, but how have you changed?
Well, I would like to think that whole episode with Arthur Lesser, who as an old man danced the Chaconne before me in his living room, was one of the key things that helped me to change. And I listening to the beginning of the Chaconne from 40 years ago, I would like to think that my present recording of it, including all the other four movements, which are all dances, has a little more danceability to it. I don't know about the tempos, whether they're slower or faster, but I would hope that would be the case.
And yet nobody would profess, except, I don't know, Heifetz perhaps, but to have mastered this piece. What is it like, and it reminds you of that algebraic asymptote, the curved line that keeps approaching the axis but never gets there. What is it like to be forever getting closer to a holy grail that you can't quite master?
Well, I've given up on that concept.
Really?
of perfection. Obviously, it's not reachable. But you know, my last teacher was Joseph Sigeti, whose interpretations of Bach were extraordinary. And I heard him playing the Chaconne for himself in his hotel room, and I stood outside the door and listened to it. And he did things I would never dream of doing in terms of freedom. You know, certainly at that time in my life as a young man, I thought of soberly connecting all the variations in a very logical way, and so that they made perfect architectural sense. And yet he dared to take wild liberties with the music and to make stops and starts and to rush forward and hold back. And it was phenomenal, not only in its daring, but and the unified nature of the whole interpretation. He was playing it for himself. Mm. And so that was another lesson that things happen. Unusual things happen. And the way I play the first chord of the Chaconne will govern the second, and that the third. And if I do something untoward at the beginning of the movement, God knows what will happen in the middle and the end. So things happen that are unexpected, and I think rather than searching for perfection, one should just revel in the unexpected and be as quick on one's feet as possible.
We've got to come to this matter of, the jazz-like performance, maybe even conceived as a series of improvisations. Who knows how he got there? But the way you're describing it, it is every performance a live emotional adventure and search, and with a great deal of uncertainty, and never a definitive or final performance. But let's listen to your most recent recording of the Chaconne, and apart from the, away from the pyrotechnical side of it, let's listen to the plaintive D major section in the middle from your recording 40 years after the last recording we heard. We're ascending somewhere in this cathedral here. My word, what a power. I didn't mean to say that it's not pyrotechnical here or awesomely challenging to play, but there's a meditation, if not a prayer, going on there. What's that about, and how do you deliver it?
Well, now wait a minute before we go in that direction. Is this the new recording of mine, or is this still the last recording of mine 40 years ago?
This is a deep question, but it's also a simple matter of fact. Let's find out. David Miller in the control room says, this is you, the new you.
Oh, I'll tell you what it is because it has been announced incorrectly in the back jacket of the book that the first recording is the early one and that the second one that it's in chronological order, and actually it's been reversed. So what we are hearing now is what I would consider my earlier and slightly more sober version of this. Yeah, this is unquestionably the version from 40 years ago.
A soberer young man. All right, let's get intoxicated here. let's find the same section in the real new recording.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to hear the difference.
Okay. This adds to the to the lure of the chase of Bach's Chaconne.
Well, one of the reasons I decided to do this, I thought it would be interesting to record the piece again. 40 years is 40 years. And I thought it would be interesting for somebody who reads my book, a book in which the Chaconne is the star, so to speak, to hear how one musician's interpretation can move.
Right, but it also gets to this Segovia line in a conversation with Harold Schoenberg at a masterclass probably 20 years ago, but it leapt out at me in the New York Times. He said, you must play this every day of your life, the guitar transcription. And he was an old man then, but he said, but never perform it until you're 60.
Well, you see, I wish I had heard Segovia say that, because I...
What does that mean? What does
I
it
was
tell
young,
you?
I was young and foolish and played it regularly, even in my 20s. I'm not sure I agree with Segovia in the sense that the only way to learn a piece is to play it over and over again, but part of that is to perform it over and over again, too. There's experience and performance that you just can't get in the practice studio.
And there's growth, and there's listening,
right,
and there's reinterpretation. Here is the not-so-sober, past 60, Arnold Steinhardt. Arnold Steinhardt, what are you hearing now?
Well, I hear a slight variation in rhythmic impulses, a little bit of, I mean, it's very subtle because this is supposed to be doled out in dropperfuls at this point in the piece. Now it gets a little bit more ornate. Yeah, this is a little freer now than the other one. Now, I'm not making any judgments, mind you. I'm just saying, trying to call it the way I see it, but this is a little bit freer.
And who's for or against sobriety as a moral value in the performance of this kind of thing? No, we won't make judgments. We will come back to the kind of the lifetime pursuit of something like musical perfection. Our producer, David Miller, raised the question, is this God talking to Bach or Bach talking to God? We're talking about the Chaconne on Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Talking this hour about Bach's Chaconne for solo violin. Formally speaking, it is the last movement in D minor from the Partita number 2, but it is kind of a freestanding musical miracle ever since he wrote it. Arnold Steinhardt, this is the second of your books that we've talked about on the radio, and it's so interesting. Violin Dreams. From the first violinist of the Guarneri String Quartet, who's been living this adventure for a long time. In the book you write, it's hard to imagine a violinist who has passed through Bach's gravitational field untouched. Bach was my first chore, gradually my interest, and finally my quest. Talk about your relationship with Johann Sebastian Bach. I mean, arguably the greatest mind that ever lived.
Well, when I was around 14 years old, my teacher, Peter Marenblum was his name. He was a student himself of the great Hungarian violin pedagogue, Leopold Auer. He gave me the first of Bach's sonatas to study, and I opened the page, and I looked at this dense black page. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was more black than white on it, and the lines were crawling up and down the steps, and it looked more like a box that had been uncovered with a bunch of worms inside crawling around, and it frightened the heck out of me. And Marion Bloom saw quite early on that it was over my head, and he quickly went on to something else. But it made a bad impression on me. And when, as a little kid, I had thought, well, this is tedious music. And it was only when my parents took me to hear Misha Elman play it for the first time that I was absolutely bowled over. And at that point, every single teacher who I studied with threw Bach at me, and gradually I realized his greatness, but it was just greatness that was unavailable to me. It was unavailable to me because my teachers, at least according to my young mind, weren't able to explain it sufficiently. And then I finally thought, well, it's a mystery that can't be explained. And now, as a grown-up, I realize that Bach occupies this peculiar position in the world of music. Everybody's got a different idea about how to play Bach, and almost everybody thinks their idea is the only idea and the only way to play Bach. And so, you know, as a youngster and as a young man going to play Bach, they'd say to me, "Oh, that's not the way to play it. This is the way to play it." But it was extremely confusing. And then gradually, I realized that, you know, it's this gorgeous mosaic of interpretations, and you have to go your own way, and you have to lighten up a little bit about the whole subject. don't take it seriously, but don't take it seriously, you know.
Oh, don't take yourself too seriously. Yeah. And yet he's alone in the sense that he is his only rival. One time we did a radio program with Craig Smith of Emmanuel Music, who conducts a Bach cantata every Sunday in the heart of downtown Boston. Been doing it for many years, been around the cycle of 200 plus cantatas a number of times. But we did a program just around his contention that the St. Matthew Passion is the greatest of all human accomplishments, better than the pyramids or Brothers Karamazov or baseball or the U.S. Constitution, you name it. This is it.
And not people, baseball, though. He was wrong in that respect.
He's up there. But all sorts of people called, and the only serious argument was whether Bach's Mass in B minor was even greater. And then the violinists might say that, no, the Chaconne is up there. I noticed people say no other composer has written anything greater than the Chaconne, which leaves room for the thought, at least, that Bach might have written something greater than the Chaconne. But, or, you know, some people would argue that the cello suites are more lovable, also the same dance forms and whatnot. Is there any other sort of human creative mind that has left this sort of, these monument after monument after monument?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say one piece is the greatest or another piece is the greatest. I think the mark of a truly great piece is that when you're playing it, or when you're listening to it, really, it pushes everything else out of existence. And so that is, it takes over your entire mind and body and emotions. And it has, its language is your life at that very moment. And it can be the St. Matthew Passion, or it can be a beautiful Irving Berlin tune, for that matter. In a much more modest setting. There's something about a great melody that is perfect, you know. It's inevitable, and so, yes, the Chaconne is a kind of perfection. But we are blessed in music to have a lot of masterpieces, a lot of mountain clops that we mountain peaks that we as musicians have to climb and are privileged to climb.
We are indeed. But this one, again, is one of those things that all sorts of performers want to make their own, like Ellington Songs or something. Mm-hmm. They have to, mm-hmm. you know, Sinatra has to do it, or Ella Fitzgerald has to do it, or whatever. They have to do it fast or slow. I'd love to just sample some of the other instrumental versions of the Chaconne. We spoke of the Brahms piano transcription, but here is the Busoni piano transcription. We spoke of breaking the union rules to, you know, burden the violinist with four lines. Is this cheating to have all those fingers on all those piano keys to bring out the...
No, it's not cheating, but I have to say something else. I don't think this is the Busoni transcription. I think this is the Brahms. This sounds like the Brahms left-hand version, which is the unadulterated chaconne without any extra notes, merely put down one octave, at least. I believe
it's your ear against David Miller's reading.
Is that not
true? Alwajin Pratt here playing the Busoni.
Is it?
Transcription.
So oh, yes, says, now I see. No, I apologize. I humbly apologize because now I see it's going into something different. It's a little more elaborate. Yes, no, I apologize to you and
no,
to
no,
David.
No, I marvel at your ears.
Because the beginning was very simple and I'd forgotten how the Busoni starts. Yes, now it's...
What about this question of, you know, Brahms wrote it for just the left hand, famously played by Wittgenstein's brother Paul and mm-hmm. Leon Fleischer when he didn't have the use of his right hand. Is it getting around the violinist's challenge to be playing it with so many fingers on so many keys?
No. First of all, this whole idea of avoiding transcriptions because there's something unholy about them, I think is a bit silly. It's not a question of whether you should play or compose something transcribed from something else, but whether you do it well. Mm-hmm. And Bach stole from other people, if you want to call it that. You know, it was the highest form of flattery for him to take Vivaldi and redo it. And so I think it's a question, does Busoni's version work? Does Brahms' version work? Is it a piece of music that can move you and excite you? And I think both versions certainly do.
This is what we call the open source principle in music. It's out there to be improved with respect and passed on for further improvement.
Right. The chaconne I've heard on two cellos, incidentally. I've heard it on clarinet alone, and it will go on and on. I expect to hear it played on a tuba soon.
here, for comparison, is the guitar version, made famous by Segovia, in this case played by Ángel Romero. Here's a question from our website. Classically Hip writes in and says, I recently heard the piano transcription live at Carnegie Hall with Helen Grimaud, and he finds it as powerful as the violin version. The question, though, is it the power of the music that it can be transcribed for other instruments, or is it in the beauty of the player's performance that carries it?
Well, yeah, it's in the power of the music, but I mean, we're all midwives, you know, we have to mm-hmm. deliver the baby. And so it's always this combination deal, isn't it? So Grimaud delivered a wonderful performance of it. But it's obviously the power of the music that she's dealing with.
What are your thoughts on the guitar sound?
Oh, I love the way that sounds. It's gorgeous.
It is just gorgeous.
So appealing. And he loved, I don't know about, he loved the lute, and he transcribed some of his violin music for lute as well.
Talk about your violin, including your new one. But all of this is in your marvelous book is around your lifelong friend.
Well, my lifelong friend, certainly for the last 30 years, is a violin made by Lorenzo Storioni, and made in the latter part of the 18th century, and he was considered one of the last of the great Cremonese masters. And I wondered whether my violin had ever been back to Cremona since it was made, and so I brought it back on a sentimental journey and played a recital there, unaccompanied recital, played some Bach, played the chaconne, and and sort of reveled in Cremona violin lore. So it was really wonderful. I was in the town hall there that has a collection of marvelous instruments, including a Stradivari played by the great German violinist Joachim, and a violin made at the dawn of violin history by Amati, Niccolò Amati, made in 1566. And I mean, the violin presumably was created as an instrument not long before that, 25 or 30 years before that. And I picked up this violin. I was allowed to play it on the basis of my performance. It was basically an audition. The mayor the mayor of Cremona, who's part-time mayor and part-time doctor, heard me and thought, well, the guy's good enough at least to be allowed to play these instruments. So I picked up this instrument, which is over 400 years old, and you think the thing would have wood fatigue. You know, planes have metal fatigue. They're taken out of service. You'd think this would be taken out of service after all these years, and it sounded glorious. So the violin is certainly a magical creature, and I really have found a kind of soulmate in this wonderful instrument by Storioni. But right now I'm playing a brand new instrument that was made for me this summer by presumably the most famous violin maker in America. Samuel Zygmuntowicz is his name. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. Mm. Maybe it's not as romantic a venue as Cremona, but he makes
has his charms.
He makes wonderful violins, and this is a wonderful violin.
Samuel Zygmuntowicz is
Zygmuntowicz. Yeah,
Zygmuntowicz. Where is he from?
He's American.
Really?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Might even be from Brooklyn.
Tell us about there it is. It looks too old to be brand new, but...
Well, he's an artist. He's an artist not only at making violins sound beautiful, but he's an artist at making them look old, if you so desire. And so this is, instead of my having to play it for 200 years to antique it, he's done it instantly. But unbeknownst to me, I mean, he took the measurements of my violin, but he told me he was taking it just for his own education. He always took measurements of instruments that he admired, and I told him basically what kind of a sound I would like to have, and he didn't copy my instrument, but he tipped his hat in honor of it in terms of the dimensions.
Let's talk about it, and maybe you demonstrate it. Your ear is so much better than ours, whether it's distinguishing Busoni and Bach or early recordings and late, but I'd love you to sort of compare and contrast the Storioni and
Zygmuntowicz.
Well,
I wish I had brought my Storioni with me so we could have a wine tasting here, you know?
Let's do it, though.
But what would you like me to play on this?
I want to imagine us in Zygmuntowicz's shop, and you're explaining just what you want to be able to hear, having been back to Cremona.
Well, I would have told him, I don't want an instrument with a very piercing treble sound, because that's not the way I hear music. I'd like it to be on the dark side, sort of rich and ambrosial sounding. On the other hand, not too dark, because a violin that's too dark doesn't have the kind of edge that you need in a concert hall. And I play concerts in halls that can have 300 people or 3,000 people in them. And so a violin has to be capable of projecting to the last row of Carnegie Hall or Symphony Hall, since we're here in Boston. And so it's something for a violin maker to come up with something like that. So, I mean, I played something like the last movement of a Brahms sonata for him. Just to give him an idea of what I wanted a violin to sound, I did that on my Storioni, of course. And, you know, I know nothing about violin making, but he listened and he thought, and then he made his plans, and he said, it'll take you 3 or 4 years and you'll have a violin.
My word. I mean, it sounds like pianists talking to their tuner about voicing or getting the hammers exactly right, but this is infinitely more complicated.
Oh, it is enormously complicated. The last time I was at his shop to pick this violin up, he had just come back from North Carolina. There was a big article about this in the New York Times a few days ago. And some scientist has gotten a violin, I think this was Jimmy Lynn's Stradivarius, and had someone play it and had it recorded by three laser cameras, and then played it back slow motion with exaggerated motions, and it looked like a belly dancer. You know, it was really quite amazing. So, you know, he's not only a highly gifted guy, but he's very inquisitive, and I think that's going to help.
Did you say Ambrosia, this is it?
Yes.
Arnold Steinhardt, it is such a pleasure. It is such a pleasure to hear a musician talk about the Chaconne, but just about pure beauty in what you do. Thank you enormously.
Well, it's my great pleasure, Christopher.
We go out with your latest version of the Chaconne. David Miller checked it twice.
Okay, and I just wanted to mention that if you go to my website, which is www.arnoldsteinhardt.com, the original manuscript of the Chaconne is on there, as well as my two different performances.
Calligraphy at the highest level. You can keep talking about the Chaconne. You can help us work on the next shows at Open Source, radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton. Ray Fallon was our engineer. Thanks also to Alice Abraham. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.